Welcome to another episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies, the Talking Pictures podcast. I'm Neil Rosen, and I'm really happy today because one of our Talking Pictures television show regulars is here on the podcast, Logan Hill. How you doing there, Logan?
I'm good. I missed you, man.
I miss you.
You're sitting around with us now.
Yeah.
Bill McCuddy is here as always, as is Bill Bregoli.
There was a fire in the fireplace.
And
what happened?
Logan, before we get in, what you doing? You're writing for Rolling Stone. You're writing for the New York Times.
Yeah, we're just getting ready to go to Sundance. I'll be there for the duration. And then from the opening day until about the middle of the next week, I'm going to be moderating Times Talks in the headquarters there. So we're going to have Ira Glass and Miranda July. We're like reaching out and booking people every day. And that's cool because every year you get to go down there and meet people you've never seen before.
And that's right? On the Times website?
Yeah, we'll be live streaming those every day. We'll be doing them around 11:30 Mountain Standard Time. You can look at timestalks.com to see when we'll be doing them. One thing I'm excited about is I think it's Tuesday. We're going to do a panel that's all actors you've never seen before or have seen very little of who've got breakout roles at this year's Sundance. And, you know, we'll see. It's like
there's always Variety's 10 people to watch every year. And the
cool. Very similar to that. And, it's cool. Like, I mean, I remember going to Sundance and interviewing people I'd never seen before on screen, like Jennifer Lawrence with Winter's Bone, having a cup of coffee with her before everything happened with her. Vera Farmiga, when she was there, nothing was happening for her. You know, I mean, it's every year you meet somebody at that festival. Carey Mulligan was in Education a couple of years ago, and you end up hearing about them for the next decade.
We'll talk about Vera in a moment.
We're going to talk about The Commuter. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about the Golden Globes. We're going to talk a little bit even about Fire and Fury, the Trump book. We're going to talk about a bunch of things. By the way, to Logan's point, interviewing all these unknown people, is there a junket or interview that any of you have passed on where the people were nobody and you said, like, I'm not doing this, and then you regretted it once you saw the movie or once these people became like...
I don't remember that. I do remember getting booked Justin Long and Jonah Hill for, would it have been Superbad or...
I know the movie, something
maybe Jeremy Piven was into, and I just thought... I mean, we did the interview, and I thought they were okay, but I just thought, wow, I don't know what's going to happen to those guys. So I'm a really lousy judge of talent, which is why I'm still friends with Neil Rosen.
The weird thing about this business, right, is you can watch some actor's first film, and it'll be total crap. And it doesn't have anything to do with them as an actor in their career. Like almost every actor we love had, one of their first three movies was total garbage. And so I'm sure we were all pitched interviews at that point and passed and said,
True Romance, and when you saw Brad Pitt as a stoner, would you have imagined that he was going to go on and have the career he's had?
In
True Romance.
True Romance, no.
He was like a pretty boy from Oklahoma, right? Nobody thought he was an actor.
To be honest with you, but there were films.
He's just a man who never says no.
I never said no, and I actually remember the first roundtable interview. It was a favor. Please, please. It's John Voight's daughter. Her name is Angelina. Wow. She's in this movie, and it was called Foxfire. And I remember mostly because she takes her top off in the movie, frankly. But it was please,
Bill,
please. It
we
was
so desperately try and clean up your act, and every
and it
week
never works. Never, I know
you never disappoint.
One that I passed
but
on.
She showed us her tattoos. She was like lifting up articles of clothing. She was telling about her pet snakes.
This is before Gia, obviously.
Yeah, this is before Gia, before she was anybody. And talking about how she liked to play with knives.
Really?
This is before she became the Madonna figure she is now.
Or Mrs. Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, but before she came in, Mrs. United Nations. This was way early, and she was a strange
girl. Neil wouldn't have brought this up if he didn't have a great story about somebody passed on.
No, I just... Welcome to the Dollhouse. They pitched me this, and...
Heather Mazur, right? Is that her name?
Matarazzo.
I didn't know who Todd Solondz was. I'd never heard of him. I never had heard of Heather Matarazzo. Then I saw the film, and I'm like, man, I love this film. This
right.
was just
Maybe you were right about Heather. What's she done?
She did
Todd, great. But Heather, I thought, know. You know, this is so kind of a...
She actually did one of the Hostel films.
Oh, really?
Eli Roth, yeah. Oh. And then she was in The L Word, I think, for a short period of time.
Boy, Eli Roth is remaking Death Wish.
Oh, I saw this.
Have you seen that, Neil?
I haven't seen the movie, but I saw the...
The trailer, the trailer's everywhere.
Well,
guess who the
that's
new
all prime for a remake. I mean, that was like, I don't know, almost 50 years ago, right?
Except he's not an architect this time. He's like a doctor or I can't remember, but it's Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis, Neil, is the new Charles Bronson.
Interesting.
Well, I think it's...
We've lost Neil to his telephone. He's looking something up.
I'm looking up another movie that I remember that we had...
Passing on?
We had to interview in order to get Tom Cruise or something for Junket. The studio made us interview, and he was nobody at the time. Colin Hanks and...
he's still nobody.
And no, he's in some show on TV. That's,
no, he is.
And Sissy Spacek's daughter. And I think they made us do this... It's to the junk. And you got to do this because they couldn't fill out the date card of that other movie. It was, anyway.
Did that have orange in the name?
What's that?
That movie have orange?
Orange County.
Yeah.
Orange County. What was Sissy Spacek's daughter's name? Well, what is her name? See, look at that. That career didn't really take off, did it?
She became a singer, actually. She sings full time.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But at the time...
Her name doesn't sing, does it?
No. It was like, so basically you're making us do Tom Hanks' son... And Sissy Spacek's daughter, in order to
the old joke, God has a girlfriend. All right, so
let's move on. These Australian tap dancers. So we saw the celebrity interview.
We saw the commuter. Bill Bregoli and I went to the premiere last night on Monday night in New York City. Bill McCuddy went to a screening of it
2 days earlier.
And
pinch me.
You know what, Bill? Why don't you take the lead on it?
I will until you interrupt me. Here we go. Liam Neeson is an insurance agent at first. That's what you think. And he's laid off from his job. He commutes in every day on the, what's it called, the Metro North?
Metro North, yeah.
Yes.
Outside of New York into New York City.
Right. Into Grand Central.
And, yeah, and it goes in and out of Grand Central. He commutes. He's laid off. And he's having drinks with his buddy, Patrick Wilson, who, he's a cop or current cop.
He's a cop. And we learn 10 minutes into the movie that Liam Neeson, who we thought was an insurance salesman, used to be a cop. What are the odds?
He has a special set of skills. Yeah, he does. Which he uses during the movie. Anyway, while he's on the train, this interesting-looking blonde woman strikes up a conversation with him, asking him...
who they describe later in the movie as being in her mid-30s, and I thought that must have been contractual for Vera, because Vera Farmiga is like in her like mid-50s, right? Or early 50s, let's say?
Well,
no, she's not young. Yeah, I'll look it up. I mean, she's not in her mid-30s. I'm not trying to be rude, but it's just not the case.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, she makes him an offer to point out a person on the subway. She says, you have skills. You used to be a... Did she mention there, Annette, that he...
Yeah, she mentions that he used to be a policeman.
Yeah.
It won't be a problem for somebody who used to be a policeman. And what you left out is this starts out as a very innocuous conversation between two people who meet cute in a romantic comedy, but this is just... They're sitting across from each other on this train, and she says, I study people for a living. What if you ran into somebody and they asked you this hypothetical thing, and that sets the whole movie into motion?
What if they asked you... They said that there's $25,000 in the bathroom of this train, and there's another $75,000, and all you have to do is find somebody on the train. Yeah, and it's just, it's just hypothetical and blah, 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 and that's...
And that's how it gets cut, and then it gets going. And that's really all we need to say. And then all hell breaks loose on the train. I read or heard somewhere I was...
We've got your family. You better find that person.
There you go.
Or they'll be dead.
I heard they actually only used one train car, and they just kept redressing it.
I spoke to Patrick Wilson actually at this after party that I got invited to. That I invited you to also, Bill.
Yes,
Bergoli.
But I wanted to go home and drink.
And Patrick Wilson said the entire thing, although it takes place in New York, was filmed in London at Pinewood Studios, except for just a few. They did like 1 or 2 day shoot of a couple of exterior shots with Liam in New York. But there's a bar scene in the beginning when Liam is in the bar with Patrick Wilson in London. There's the it is one train, one car that they redress 25 million times. And there's a lot of action in it. You know, I think, and I'm not going to use your words, but you described the movie to me one way, Bill.
Ridiculously entertaining.
Yeah, it is. It's in Liam Neeson.
It's ridiculous, and it's entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Liam Neeson action film. I thought nonstop was more with the same director, the same guy on a plane was more fun. But this was fun. I mean, it's like, you know,
he's been everywhere. What's the next one? Like a Zeppelin or the subway or
one of those pedicabs in New York City. Pedicab.
I have a question. So I've been seeing all these action movies, and now that you've got CGI, right? Like you can do everything. You blow up a planet, blow up two planets, blow up 12 planets. You can, you know, jump like the new Star Wars, jump from scene to like setup to setup.
Right.
Right. I think there's something about films like this that are contained, right? Like if you set it in one place. Like the Raid, you know?
Right. It makes them like a breath of fresh air. It makes them like interesting and cool because they're not going off the charts with all of the CGI capabilities. I agree with that. I think that's
but
well
there
said.
There are some action sequences with this train towards the end of the movie, which incorporate an enormous amount of CGI.
Right.
But nonetheless, I like a film that in an action film that is contained to a singular place, like Speed, if the bus goes under, was it 50 miles an hour? You know, 55. Blow,
yeah. 55. Like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of fun. You know, I think the plot on this, but you're not really going there for the plot, is kind of confusing and convoluted by the end. It's kind of like, but you're not really going there for that. It's just watch Liam Neeson.
Watch a 65-year-old guy kick butt, which for those of us over a certain age.
AARP's action man.
Right,
yeah.
That's exactly what he's doing. And
remember, the screenwriter says he's got an everyman vibe that people want and that you always root for him to succeed and win because that's why they're plugging him into all of these movies.
Every man is 6'4" and Irish.
Yeah, every guy is absolutely
Logan, how much longer do you think Liam Neeson, who is 65, although he says he's 60 in the movie, how much longer do you think he could keep making?
Vera, by the way, is 45.
I kind of think as long as they keep paying him. I mean, you know, he said after the first Taken, I think that's it for me. I've done enough of these action films.
After the first Taken?
Yeah, after
that was his first action film.
Yeah, he's like, you know, this isn't really it for me. And then he said it, I think he said the same thing after every action film. And right now it just seems like he's negotiating his rate, right? Like he's just getting paid more and more to do these films that he's leading. And he's great at it. I don't know. I feel like... I mean, you could definitely feel, I think now, especially with CGI and how tricky you can be shooting stuff, you don't have to be an athletic actor.
Yeah, but there's a freshness date. Remember Harrison Ford did that one with Paul Bettany? They fought, and it was really obvious that there was that in the real world Paul Bettany would have kicked the shit out of him. But and even Harrison at the end said, "You know what? I don't think I'm doing this anymore." So Liam's got to come to that decision.
Well, but you know, Denzel's doing Equalizer 2 this year, and that'll be a test of that too, right? Like he's been able to just—he's not going to fight anybody.
We
got to
talk about how happy Denzel looked at the Golden Globes the other night. But we'll get to that when we talk to him about the Golden Globes.
Well, Liam, I interviewed Liam for the first Taken Junket, and he was not doing any action films prior to that. And I said, you know, you're Oscar Schindler from Schindler's List, and you were Michael Collins, and you were, was Kinsey before, was Kinsey?
I think so. I don't know.
He's doing all these, like, I go, why are you doing this? And he said to me, I learned, he goes, because I can. And he goes, I always wanted to do this, and before I get too old to do this, I want to try this.
Well, that question needs to be revisited.
Turned on a dime, and then I remember talking to him, like, Taken 2, and he goes, that's it. We're not doing any more of these, you know? And then I did it for Taken 3, and he goes, you said after Taken 2, you weren't doing another Taken. Now you, he goes,
how many more European vacations can he take?
He's like, well, they paid me a lot of money, which I thought was a very honest answer. Mm-hmm. And Bill Brigoli, you spoke to Liam Neeson.
Sure. I asked him. Actually, he mentioned that he's very familiar with this train route in the film.
I've been on this train that our line is based on. We use a fictitious line, but the actual train line I've been on 70, 80, 85 times over the past 20 years. Yeah, I know that line very well.
And then he was asked if he would do what his character does in the movie where he has to make a decision. Would he make the same decision?
For my guy, it's definitely a moral dilemma. He needs money. He's lost his job. So that all has to be taken into account. I would have done exactly what he did, actually. Yes, I would, especially if there was a chance to get $100,000 at the end of it, you know?
So if I'm on the Metro North and I see him, I'll know A, something bad is going to happen, but B, he'll be able to take care of it. Yeah, so no, that's
reason,
comforting.
No reason to get up out of your seat, Bill.
By the way, the Metro North in this film, the Metro North in this film stops at 86th Street, 79th, 72nd,
yes,
125th.
It seems to jump the Metro North tracks and get on the subway for some reason for like about 10 minutes.
So the film goes off the rails literally in a couple of places.
That's very good. That's very true. Well, I don't know. I enjoyed it for what it is. I like these. I mean, if you're looking for a Liam Neeson, you know, escapist entertainment fair, mindless kind of thing.
Listen, January, as we always talk about, is a dumping ground. And so this is a better than average January movie. I think it's worth seeing on the big screen. Neil loves to say this is something you can wait for. That's something you don't need to pay full price for. No, this is a go see it in the regular movie theater.
Either way is fine. You know, I mean, after seeing all this, you know, Oscar contender kind of heavy stuff, it was kind of refreshing to see, you know, like, yeah, here's Liam Neeson kicking ass.
In a ridiculous plot.
Well, the plot becomes incomprehensible.
You'll laugh. I swear to God, you'll laugh every time his cell phone rings because it just seems to at every opportune moment.
Even though he loses his cell phone in the first minutes of the movie.
And then other people's cell phones start ringing. I mean, it's laugh out loud funny in places, but...
Without giving much away, the movie, what did Vera Farmiga work like? 2 days on the film, if that. I mean, think about
that. Oh, yeah.
That.
No, absolutely.
You know, but let's not divulge that aspect of it. But
a little late for that.
Yeah, the cell phone is late. Yes, I have your family. You have to do something. Time is running out. And then Mike, the guy who plays Mike in Breaking Bad and Saul, shows up in this thing for a little bit, too. I like that actor.
He's the same hairstyle as Logan.
Exactly.
All right, so anyway... So I would recommend it, and Bill Bregoli would.
I recommend it, sure.
Yeah, okay. You know,
I agree with Patrick Wilson, who said last night on the red carpet, it's like an Alfred Hitchcock movie shoved through an action movie meat grinder. It's a pretty apt description, and he said he'd always wanted to make. He'd been watching these Liam Neeson movies for 10 years. He always wanted to be in one, and now he is.
Well, there you go. There you go. And Logan, did
I missed the train? But now you guys are convincing me. I got to hop on.
Do you like the Liam Neeson action kind? Yeah. Genre of stuff.
I think he's good. I think he's, you know, he's funny because, you know, like even if the plot is laugh out loud in some of his action movies, I feel like he's never in on the joke. Like he's never winking. He's never been like an ironic action hero. And we have a lot of those right now.
He's the Sean Connery Bond, not the Roger Moore Bond.
Exactly. Yeah. He's in it.
So, you know, the Golden Globes were on this past weekend. And it struck me afterwards, and we're going to talk about this whole show, which is unlike any, not only any Golden Globe Awards I've ever seen in the past, it was unlike any award show I've seen in the past because it was, you know, kind of, well, we'll get into that. But I noticed that there was not an in memoriam reel, and I was wondering, do they not do that on the Golden Globes?
They don't.
They never do
they
that.
They don't. No.
Okay. No.
Okay. Because you were talking about Roger Moore. Roger Moore was one of the
right.
people.
And this
passed.
Year they could have done careers. They could have done Harvey Weinstein. They could have had Matt
Kevin
Lauer.
Spacey.
I have
Spacey.
To tell you that.
Put a big paper shredder on
Seth Meyers tried to go for it a bunch of times with the Kevin Spacey references and the a couple of Harvey Weinstein jokes. And, you know, I had talked to Bob Newhart earlier that day. And I asked because he was one of the first people to win a Golden Globe for television, like in 1962. And he's a comedian also. And he said that Seth will do a good job. But he said he's absolutely going to have to deal with the 200-pound gorilla in the room, which is Harvey Weinstein. And then sure enough, Seth Meyers did a joke exactly like that. And then many, many other jokes, because I think you had to deal with it. I think if he hadn't, it would have looked like he'd settled or been gotten to. But I did say to myself, I sure wish this was Ricky Gervais making harder.
Me too. Me too. And I'm not a big fan of Ricky Gervais, but I would have really liked to see what Ricky Gervais would have done.
And I think the ratings reflected it. It didn't do as well as when Jimmy Fallon hosted.
But it was one of their best in a decade.
Or Tina or Amy. And Amy Poehler was there and was kind of funny, but kind of like spoke for all of us when she was yelling at Seth. We know that. Move on. And that's kind of how I felt. And this is going to get a lot of hate mail, but that's kind of how I felt about the Me Too thing that night. I thought it was Me Too much. It was a night that's supposed to honor the movies and television, and it did, but it didn't lose any opportunity to make the Me Too statement. And I thought,
well, it did.
Oprah was great.
Well, it's now not even, it wasn't Me Too, it was Time's Up. It was the,
Right. Well, both are applicable. The woman who founded both of founded the Me Too thing was there. That was the other thing. It was like the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, where bring a newsworthy buddy to the Golden Globes. So they had all of these people who had been wronged, and they brought them as their guests. And look, I'm totally for equality, and I think Harvey's a scumbag and all of that stuff. But a little goes a long way, and a lot gets old fast.
Well, it's a 3-hour telecast, and you know. I mean, this was the main theme of the telecast. I mean, you know, I don't know if you, you know, if you were able to monitor the ratings, if they went, if there was a fatigue factor with that, you know, if the ratings went down as the telecast went along. I don't know. I'd like to see those numbers, but
I would say, like, some of the best moments of the show were about, like, you know, Oprah's speech, which I think everybody agrees was the hype. Like, whether or not you,
President Winfrey,
presidential ambitions, that was a hell of a speech. Everybody got up out of their seats, and it was interesting to me the contrast between, like, you know, Seth Meyers, who's kind of uncomfortable and saying, hey, I can't make these jokes. Can somebody else help me make them? You know, and he's done that on his late night show. And the other, but more so the other men on the show compared to the women. Because there wasn't to my memory, I don't think a single man on stage, many of whom have worked with Harvey, many said a word about Harvey or said a word about Me Too. And it was only the women left talking about this issue again. And that bugs me to a certain extent. It makes you wonder, like, how many of these guys feel like, oh, I'm vulnerable. Like James Franco, you know, right. He's had people say, oh, he hit on me on Instagram when I was 17. Ali Sheedy comes out and tweets about him after the show. And you like, did he not say anything because he was more worried about saying anything at all?
He kind of dissed Tommy. He brought Tommy up there. And Tommy moves to the microphone. That gif has gone out of control.
So much on Twitter when he pushes him, Tommy Wiseau. But listen, let's face it. Tommy Wiseau, I mean, this guy got, I mean, through a really crazy route, got to be famous.
But it's my movie. It's my movie. And I didn't get to say anything. And then after they win, they go backstage and they send me to my table. You see that moment as they're walking off the stage?
Yeah.
Dave Franco and James Franco go backstage and Tommy goes back to, like, looks like he's going to wait tables. I mean, it was...
Well, I love the story that Seth Rogen told about that there was this big billboard for The Room. Like, when did that movie come out? 1980-something?
Three, maybe, I think.
Right, yeah. So Seth Rogen's not famous, and he says he's driving around Hollywood, and there's this huge billboard somewhere. I guess it was on Hollywood Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, and there's a phone number, and if you call
the
phone
and you call the guy.
Tommy Wiseau picks up the phone, and he goes, he called the number.
It's playing at 4:30, 7:15, and 9 o'clock.
But I'm thinking, where did they... You know, okay, so he obviously had unlimited money, Tommy Wiseau.
You want a coupon code?
For The Room, which is, by the way, if nobody's following this, the movie The Disaster Artist, which James Franco, and I'm really thrilled that he won the Golden Globe for that performance because I think it's such a great performance. So he's got unlimited money and he gets the money to make the movie, but how does he distribute the movie? Like, how does he get the movie into theaters?
I think he four-walled himself. I think he bought the rooms the way they
studios do. I want to show my movie tonight.
I'm pretty sure it was only in New York, too. I mean, I'm sorry, in Los Angeles. I'm not sure that they talked that much about it, although it became a cult classic after that and ran in other places. But, you know, where he got his money from is still one of the burning questions. A lot of people think it's the mob or he was from a wealthy family that they... can't, but it seems like this day and age you'd be able to find out where anybody got anything
from. They can't even place where he's from.
By the way, to your point about when we were talking earlier about the In Memoriam reel, and you said they could have had a career killer reel. I don't know if it's up on YouTube, but it's certainly on the Comedy Central site. If you want to see a brilliant 4 minutes, The Daily Show had a special at the end of the year called The Yearly Show, and they did an In Memoriam thing like what you're talking about, Bill, on people's careers. But they showed the most unbelievable clips of, like, for example, Kevin Spacey would sit there. They showed an actual clip of Kevin Spacey going, I hate bullies. When I'm on a movie set and I see a bully, you know, or they had Matt Lauer running around the halls of the Today Show in his underwear. And Katie Couric is going, again, Matt, again. it, and they go through every, they find the most unbelievable, I don't know, the researchers, whoever did this, you got to give them really.
But you know, that's all out there for about everybody. I mean, Mother Teresa has a video of her, like, sitting on a whoopee cushion or something. I mean, it's all out there. It's just about going and finding it. Everybody's had embarrassing moments.
It's
everybody's
hard to find.
Done.
I mean, I'm saying the research.
No,
the right clip.
Yeah, know. Congratulations. But I mean, we've all done things that in retrospect would look bad if you wanted to take them out of context.
That's true. So anyway, by the way, did you like the, since we have Logan Hill here, and I'm thrilled.
I'm thrilled.
Did you like the Disaster Artist?
I love the Disaster Artist. Yeah.
Would that have been on your top 10 list, Logan?
You know, and I didn't make one this year because I have one of those years where I have been catching up on a number of films late. But yeah, I think I would put that on my top 10.
It was on yours, like, wasn't it, Neil?
Not only was it on mine, it would be like, I didn't do it in in order, but it's definitely on my list. But if I did put it in order, it would be near the top of the list. I love that movie. I just love that movie. I watched it again. I haven't done that with any movie.
Do you hate Lady Bird less now than it's won the Golden Globe?
I don't.
And Saoirse Ronan.
Time. I got to do this every podcast. I don't hate Lady Bird like Lisa Rossman. Really can't stand the movie. I think it's okay. I just don't think it's worth it. Despite it winning the Golden Globe, I don't think it's the best.
May win the Oscar for a bunch of reasons.
Well, I love Lady Bird, but let's talk about a bigger point, which is that the Golden Globes are completely bogus.
Yeah, well,
and I think, like, every breath we spend talking about...
But they've
about,
been trying, like, in the last 10 years to clean up their act, and every year they get a little better at predicting the Oscars.
It's still these nobodies.
Yes.
These
I understand
totally
that.
Illegitimate
yes,
nobody junket writers who just don't know what the fuck they're talking about, who are still the ones picking the awards.
Absolutely.
And that's just, it just, I mean, like,
I said this,
I think
the
they generally nominate good movies, right?
We don't really know who's voting for the Oscars,
but
it's certainly
but
a much more credible.
Of
course they do.
And I've said this on the podcast many times. It's a guy that's got a newsletter in Ecuador read by like 15 people, and he's one of the 100 voters that vote for the Golden Globe.
Okay, but I'll tell you, I'll remind you of the story that Sam Jackson told me on a junket, which is that he doesn't even vote for the Oscars. His maid does it. He puts it on the kitchen table. That story went around the world and almost got him kicked out of the Academy. Sorry, Sam. But you know, I'm not sure the credibility of voting has anything to do with it because...
Really?
There's no question that the Golden Globe voters are suspicious. They work for the Warsaw Penny Saver or whatever these crazy places are.
Haven't written in the last 20 years, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, but they've only got the same pool to pick from that everyone else does, and they only, I mean, the BAFTAs today decided Paddington 2 is a decent screenplay and nominated it. So you can take the most credible group in the world, and they're still going to come up with some crazy nominations every now and then. What I think is a more credible group is that as we tape this, we are voting today and in 2 days on the CW, the Critics' Choice Awards by the Broadcast Film Critics will be telecast. That's about 350 strong. They're all working journalists because if they're not, they get kicked out. Some are bloggers and on the internet, which I think skews a younger voting audience. And so we'll see. Olivia Munn is hosting this year because T.J. Miller, who's done it for the last 2 years, has had a little of his own Me Too kind of trouble.
Before that happened, I spoke to the people that run the BFCA, T.J. Miller, before that scandal broke, T.J. Miller was not coming back for a third year.
Okay, but Olivia Munn,
not why he's not
Olivia Munn, who is in the press release as being very vocal about women's rights and equal pay, is the host. So
will she wear black?
We'll see on Thursday night. Again, if you're hearing this after Thursday, you already know the Critics' Choice winners. But I don't disagree with the Golden Globes being a crazy group. But, you know, at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, they are influencing in some way what the awards shows do after
that. Okay.
Oh, no, and I do think they're really influential. I'm not saying they're not influential. I'm saying that I wish they weren't.
<You know? laughs> No, I agree. Well,
It's become a huge deal in large part because of people like Harvey, who created the Golden Globes as a major TV event, which it didn't used to be.
Right. You know?
I've said this again, pardon the redundancy, but since you're sitting on the
podcast. We always do.
This is such a long story. I'll try to make it very brief. It's the first award show. Dick Clark bought this award show. They ran it on TBS originally because there was only the Oscars, the Emmys, the Tonys, and the Grammys. there were no other, and he saw all the ratings on those shows and said, I want to.
So we have Dick Clark to blame, is basically the headline here.
So they got there first. Not first, other than the Big Four. This is before the People's Choice Awards or the, you know.
MTV Awards.
Got it. Understood.
Right.
In a desperate effort to make this long story short, as you had promised it would be, I'm going to just cut you off there and say, we get it. We get it. But so the point is, if we are going to take the Golden Globes with some grain of truth, what's the headline coming out of there? Is Three Billboards, which won for Best Drama, going to win at the Oscars?
I think the profile. What do you think?
Will Lady Bird win?
Do you think that the profiles on Three Billboards has gone up to such an extent that now it's like a major contender for winning Best
Picture? No, if anything, though, Golden Globes may hurt it.
How so?
They zig and zag. That is true. When we were talking about the influence, I wanted to make the point that sometimes the Oscar voters don't want to do what Golden Globe has done. Mm-hmm. And so it's. Yeah. I think it's definitely in the mix now. Well, I thought that was a movie, by the way.
We'll get a whole lot more Oscar attention now.
Logan,
I think it'll affect
Get
Out.
Get Out has had a shot of winning Best Picture?
And remember Three Billboards, it was also Sam Rockwell and Frances McDormand. And for it to pick up three major awards was... Just
screenplay also.
Oh, which four.
Yeah, it got screenplay.
Man,
so
it's crazy.
Did you like that? Would that have been on your top 10 list?
No. I like Martin McDonagh, and I thought that's one.
Amen, brother. I don't get this whole Three Billboards.
No. I love Three Billboards.
I mean, I think there's some great performances in it, and I love Sam Rockwell. We're still talking over here. I love Sam Rockwell, but like, and she's long overdue. If Frances McDormand, you know, desperately,
won an Oscar.
Yeah, but it's a long time ago. I mean, they love her. I don't know, Bill.
I'm with you on it.
Overrated?
Overrated and very confused kind of movie. Interesting, kind of fun to watch, but at the end of it, I left a bad feeling in my mouth after.
I don't think it's confusing at all. I think it's not overrated because I don't think that many people are...
Neil, it says there are three billboards outside of Fleming's, and there are.
I don't know.
Fact check.
I enjoyed the movie. I saw it at the Hampton Film Festival. I liked it very much. So with my wife, she liked it very much. I thought that Frances McDormand was great. I thought the story was very interesting. I think Sam Rockwell, yes, you put lesser actors in those roles, and I don't think that...
We're voting tonight. What are you going to vote for the Critics' Choice Awards?
All right, give me the choices.
Is Three Billboards the winner? You're not voting for Lady Bird.
For the Best Picture?
Yeah, for Best Picture, yeah.
Read me the 10, and I'll tell you.
All right, hold on.
All right, the Best Picture nominees are The Big Sick.
Overrated.
Call Me by Your Name.
Good.
Darkest Hour, as we would say in Boston. Dunkirk. The Florida Project. Get Out. Lady Bird. The Post. The Shape of Water. And yet there's more. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Okay. The best movie?
Well, what are you voting for? We have to fill out these ballots tonight by 9:00.
Well, I'm going to pick Lady Bird because Lady Bird was my number one movie of the year. But I will tell you, Dunkirk would be my backup, and I think Dunkirk has a really good chance of winning the Oscar.
I do too.
You like Dunkirk?
I love both of those movies.
Wow.
Yeah, I think Lady Bird. I mean, my top four is some mix of like Lady Bird, Get Out, Dunkirk, and Call Me by Your Name. I might put Call Me by Your Name as my favorite film. I just watched it again. And even though I think Dunkirk is incredible movie making, right? It's like pure cinema.
There's no dialogue. There's no...
No style.
It's no, I didn't say style. I said there's no screenplay. It's just...
That's fine.
Not for me.
I don't know. It's worked in a lot of
I'm going with Dunkirk.
You're going with Dunkirk.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to go with... Man.
Take your Three Billboards you loved so much.
It's either Three Billboards, The Post, or Darkest Hour, which I... All right. I'm going to go...
Darkest Hour won't win.
All right,
Darkest
Hour
is
going to
win Best Actor.
I'm going with Three Billboards. Between The Post and Three Billboards, I'll go with Three Billboards.
All right, so I apologize for cutting you off earlier because what you were starting to ask Logan was about Get Out and whether this whole Get Out movement is really legitimate. And
I
then
asked
you just
Logan
said
if you thought
it's
it
in your first four.
Picture.
It's in your top four.
I think it's a great film, and I think that. Well, I do think that like awards season wise, every year we've been saying whether it's The Dark Knight or other films that genre films deserve a place in the best picture discussion. It's crazy that the movies that we watch every year we just throw out at the end of the year when we talk about awards. And that movie was one of the biggest breakout hits of the year, probably the most profitable movie of the year.
It's also the most colorful movie of the year in terms of getting some people of color into the nominations because everything else that we expected to do well, like Detroit and
that
Mudbound doesn't count because Mudbound wouldn't be up for an Oscar.
Why?
But is it Oscar
Yeah, we got the screener.
I think it qualified.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay, so but okay, well,
you're
but
really
maybe I'm dismissing it only because it hasn't really gained any traction. So Get Out is sort of the de facto sort of nominee for that reason.
If you take the political statement out of Get Out, it is structurally, it is a run-of-the-mill horror movie. That
it's
is
like
just,
taking, let's saying, like, let's take the war out of Dunkirk, or let's take love out of, Love Actually.
If you get halfway through Get Out, it's let's get out of the house, let's escape from the thing. It's just the convention of thousands of horror films of, like, oh, he's almost out of the house, but no, wait, here comes somebody. It's this, other than that social commentary about, that an African-American guy that is being hypnotized by all these, you get that plot element out of there, which is addressed early on, it becomes the regular conventions
I think that convention deepens and gets more interesting as you go through the movie. But I also think, like, you can't say about any movie, like, let's take the central conceit out of it. Like, you can't say, well, if Lady Bird wasn't a coming-of-age movie, if it didn't have a teenage girl in it. I mean, like, I don't know.
Lady Bird's a perfect example because it just upped the ante of all coming-of-age movies. And I think even if I agree with your point about it's just one of those genre films, it's the best one that's been done in so long that it actually ups the ante or raises the bar.
This is my same problem with Lady Bird. Since you're always goofing on me, always giving me shit for not loving Lady Bird.
Not even in your top 10, Lady Bird.
No, I mean, okay. I've seen that movie. Look, it's an all right movie, but I've seen that movie in dozens, if not 100 other coming of age movies. Maybe it's,
A better one, though. Ever Better?
Ever Better?
Ever Better?
What is Ever Better?
It's a question. Have you ever seen that genre done better? If you're going to say you've seen that movie before a million times, what's the better one?
A billion.
16 times. Candles?
I got to think about that.
Yeah, okay.
No,
Get back to us.
I got to think about that.
I'm saying is everybody says Spielberg rips off, Hitchcock was ripped off by De Palma. They all will tell you that it doesn't matter who you rip off as long as you do it better. So if this is the best coming-of-age movie you've seen, then why don't you like it?
Of a coming-of-age movie, not just a mother-daughter thing, just a coming-of-age thing?
Both. Put them both in the blender.
Okay, here's some coming-of-age movies that I think are better than Lady Bird.
Okay.
Okay. Did you ever see The Sure Thing with John Cusack
yes.
and the Rob Reiner?
Yes.
Not better.
Okay?
Not better.
That's okay. The coming of a car to pick up somebody and go for a ride.
I love that movie, okay? All right, how about The Spectacular Now?
Great film, not as
very
good.
Very good, but not as good.
Great coming-of-age movie. How about the one?
Why wasn't that in the Oscar discussion a couple of years ago?
How about the one with Alexander Sarsgaard where he's this... Diary of a Teenage Girl. That is just
very
so...
Good film.
Very good movie.
So bold.
No Lady Bird, but very
such
good.
Such a bold film, and I think that's...
You know, I never expected you to make my point this well when I asked you this question.
Well, I told you to give me a moment to think about it. I'm giving you coming-of-age movies that,
no,
that
no,
I
get
prefer.
It, but I happen to think these are better.
And I don't dislike Lady Bird.
All right.
It's okay, but I think that there are better movies. All of a sudden, I don't understand why people are saying... This is the greatest movie. You know, it could be the best picture of the year. I don't see it. I just don't see it.
Well, I'm going to tell you one thing.
Lisa Rossman apparently
is the whole Me Too movement may get it an Oscar for best picture.
You think
the way Get Out is in the right place at the right time this year to be the Oscars so white country contrarian, this Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig, the It Girl of the Year, it's coming together for her, I think. Possibly. It's just a theory. But I think Dunkirk's going to win, so don't go by me.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, if you think about Nolan and the success he's had and the way his films have kind of been passed over in award circuits, I do think it's, like, no one's crying for Christopher Nolan, right? The guy's got more money than God and can make literally any movie he wants.
Did you see...
But he is like, if you still believe in old Hollywood, I think the narrative that you can attach to that, too, is this thing of cinema in the theaters. This guy released the film 70mm, who thinks the film should be seen in theaters, and you should see Dunkirk in a big-ass movie theater.
And a lot of people who vote for the Oscars are in the business part of show business, yeah. And they are scared shitless about Amazon... Prime and Netflix and all of that, and they want to support the home team. I don't know how many years from now that's going to be true, but for this year, I think it is.
I could come up with another 10 coming-of-age films, which I'm not going
to
do.
We'll look forward to that.
But I won't. But
that'll be in the DVD bonus section.
Did you see the faces, Bill Bregoli, on the five directors when Natalie Portman at the Golden Globe? You know, Ron Howard.
Actually, no, I was in a radio
control. I thought that was really mean, by the way.
I was working.
Well, first of all, if you were watching Twitter that night, Ron Howard got a lot of flack from people saying, because, you know, Oprah, she's following Oprah. Oprah gives this speech, and then he comes out and goes, all right, back to this, which I didn't think, I mean, I don't know how you follow that, and I don't know
what
what
he was saying. How do you follow that? Right. That's what he was saying.
All these people are writing on Twitter like, oh, so you're just dismissing this thing. Like, okay, we've
that's
got
bullshit.
I agree with you. I think he was, I mean, I don't know what you say. If I was Ron Howard and I was presenting with Natalie Portman, I would have said to Natalie Portman, could you do the first segue jump? Can you start talking instead?
But that's pandering to it too, Neil. That's ridiculous. All he really needed to say was something less oblique, and he just needed to say, how do you follow an incredible performance like that or an incredible speech like that? Boom.
It's
but
tricky.
Then Natalie Portman has
so
to jump in.
Say the exact
Natalie
right
Portman,
thing.
So anyway, so Natalie Portman says the five nominees for Best Director, who happen to be all male. And then they show you, even one of the talk shows last night played this, you know. I think it was Jimmy Kimmel. And shows you all the, you know, Ridley Scott and Martin McDonagh. And they all have these horribly pained
Yeah, because
looks
it's not their fault.
No, it's not. So you thought it was mean? Yeah.
I thought it was mean. I thought there was no way that when the... I don't think the Hollywood Foreign Press was thinking about... Well, first of all, it's basically only Greta Gerwig. And they'd already given her the... they gave her... She won best... Well, that won best comedy. And did she win screenplay? Or did something else win another comedy screenplay? But Saoirse won. I mean, they were heaping... That's the problem with the Golden Globes, by the way. Not to backtrack into the Globes again, but it breaks the categories up into musical comedy or drama. And in that way, they get to have their cake and eat it,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they get to give rewards to everything. A couple of quick things before we go. Logan, since we have the pleasure of your company this week on the podcast, tell me some of your favorite movies of the year this year.
You know, this is one of those years where my list is matching up more than normal with other people. Like, some of the films that are popping up on everybody's list, like The Shape of Water, I thought was just beautifully directed. It was a thin story. Yeah, it's a thin story, but it's beautifully directed.
No Pan's Labyrinth.
You know, it's No Pan's Labyrinth.
E.T. for adults.
Yeah, but I like, you know, it's not...
But I
like
it.
I love, but I really like that film.
You see one movie about interspecies sex this year.
Right. Make it.
I was a huge fan of Tangerine, and I was really, really happy to see Florida Project.
That just so bored me.
No, I thought
people this year love or hate that movie.
Yeah,
I mean, really are divided about
where you
it.
I don't think it's satisfying.
I thought it was great.
Where you
levels,
on it?
But he is a great filmmaker. He gets amazing performances out of people. You know, it's like, I feel like there's a way of talking down about directors who use non-professional actors, like it's easy. And then you think of all the films you've seen where people have tried it, and they're just horrible.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, even the trailer.
No, that's a good point. It's a gift. And
it's really hard to
But Willem Dafoe stumbled. They said he was going to win Best Supporting Actor.
Sam Rockwell. I'm starting to think Sam Rockwell's got it, you know, for Best Supporting Actor. And I think that is the Best Supporting Acting performance of the year. I really do. I mean, that character goes through, regardless... I know I stand alone here. I'm the only one that really liked this movie. But you got to give credit to that performance. I mean, you go from really hating this character to feeling something else towards him. I mean, it's quite a performance.
Wait, listen, I never give you your due, but I got to say one more thing, and then we can – I know we got to wrap it up. We're getting long. I know you – and I want to have – I have a video pick of the week. But you have been the person that's been championing the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, who they called Maisel. They called it everything on the show.
Just mispronounced it.
And she won. Rachel won. That won.
Yeah,
she's amazing. She looked like $1 million. She looked like Audrey Hepburn the other night at the Golden Globes.
She's going to be a star.
And she was really good. And that I've watched all 8 of those episodes. It's really, really good. Yeah. And I recommend it.
And my other
too.
Favorite show won, too. Master of None. Aziz Ansari.
And I'll say, on both of those, right, like, this interesting thing is happening now where we used to, you know, we're talking about breakthrough actors the other day, earlier the other day in the beginning of this conversation.
Right. Which where, feels several days old at this point.
It used to be films that broke actors more than anything else. And TV shows were, you know, kind of like second tier. And right now there's so much good, high quality work happening on Netflix and Amazon and HBO and Showtime that people like Rachel Brosnahan are breaking through there, or Lena Waithe on Master of None, or Aziz, you know, like it's becoming the engine for all these breakthrough performances.
Although, to that point, even in the old days of TV, Clint Eastwood came out of television. Paul Newman was doing those, you know, those hour
Playhouse 90s, yeah,
type things. And James Dean actually also did some of those, you know, those right. long dramas. So, but okay, so before we go, I'm reading Fire and Fury.
What page are you on?
What's that?
What page are you on?
Four, well, five. I were you upset when it wasn't a pop-up book?
I found something very interesting, since we all are movie critics, that the writer of the book is equating the Trump campaign to be president to the movies The Producers. That he's saying that Trump...
The Producers, meaning the Mel Brooks.
The Mel Brooks movie The Producers, right. That he didn't want to win, just like Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder didn't want to have a hit. And he'd be winning, he writes in the book that he'd be winning by losing because everybody, excuse me, everybody would be getting, you know, his profile would be raised, his brand would be raised, Kellyanne Conway would be a spokesperson on television, you know, be hardware in the networks, but he keeps doing these outrageous things, you know, whether you want to buy into this or not, that's a whole other conversation. But I love the comparison to my favorite comedy, The Producers, where it's like, we got to make sure this play is a bomb, you know. Well, what's the most offensive thing? We'll do a Springtime for Hitler, you know. So I just thought that was funny. But
well, apropos of that, this may be turned into a movie.
Yeah,
because Wolf was talking about it being in discussion right now with probably HBO would do it
all
best.
Right, so do the casting. Who would you cast?
Who's
I got an idea. Cast it like Saturday Night Live did with Sean Spicer. Put all women in the roles.
I think just all Melissa McCarthy. Role.
Melissa McCarthy and Steve Bannon. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, do it like a Medea's family wedding kind of thing. Yeah. She's a million costumes.
Do you do the movie? If you do the book, do you do the movie really solemnly, or do you do it like the movie W, the Oliver Stone movie, where it's funny? I mean, like there's really funny moments of it, you know? Yeah. I mean,
I hate to say too soon. I hate to say too soon, but like, I don't know whether it should be a balls out comedy or it should be like somber. I don't know. I mean, we're still in the middle of this presidency. I think that, listen, I'm not a huge fan of Trump at all. But I did read in Cindy Adams' column today, there's a whole passage about when he becomes president and it's announced, Melania breaks into tears and says, no, this is never what I wanted. This is horrible. And she, Cindy Adams, was standing next to Chris Christie and Trump and everybody else and Melania in the room. And she said she never even like swelled up with tears of joy. So that incident is completely made up, according to her. And so there may be some other things in this book that we have to take.
So you're saying that Cindy Adams was actually with the Trump family?
Yes.
During the election night?
Yes, she was. She was standing next to them.
Michael Wolff does not have a good reputation as a reporter, but, you know.
How much of that?
I liked his Murdoch book. I thought that was great.
Logan,
people who make the news or the man who makes the news.
As a writer for the New York Times and a respected journalist, how much of that book do you think is... By the way, Michael Wolff does say at the beginning of the book that he got many different stories from many different people that really didn't sync up. You know,
right.
A lot of these stories completely went
like I, Tonya.
Yeah, get the I, Tonya people.
It is kind of, I mean, his writing approach does feel like I, Tonya. He's like, well, given the choice between a really juicy version of the story and a really boring version of the story, I'll always pick the juicy one, you know? And, you know, that's a certain kind of journalism we've seen a lot of. It doesn't mean that there aren't lots of truths in the book, but, you know,
What would you think? 10%, 50%, 80%?
I have to read the book. I haven't read the book yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
And lastly, before we go, Tonya Harding for iTonya in the audience of the Golden Globes. a lot of people writing about on Twitter that they were that the glorification of Tonya Harding. Yeah. We're kind of upset about that. Your take before we go?
Oh, I love the movie. I love Tonya. I think she likes the movie. I don't think there's any. I don't think it's exploitation if she thinks it's a good portrayal. There's a 2-hour special this week on ABC talking about everything. She's going to sit down and probably say whether she likes the movie or not. So I got no problem with that. If we are wrapping it up, I got one video pick of the week, which I thought everybody was going to have. So I have been 2 months ago in your New York Times, in the men's style section, there was a great article about this guy, Johnny Agnelli, who ran Fiat and was involved with Ferrari and was like a playboy in the south of France. And there's a documentary called Agnelli on HBO, and it's got great people in it. Lee Radswell is in this thing. Valentino is in this thing. He was like an Italian prince. And so it's a fascinating, if you care nothing about cars, there's plenty about cars in it, but mostly it's about this incredibly charismatic guy who may have shtupped Jackie O and Kennedy, President
Sounds
Kennedy
like
knew
like
about
a
it.
Vidal Sassoon documentary that we saw.
No, this guy is straight and he's very cool, and he's like this incredibly charismatic guy. And the reason I bring it up is I know that they're making a Ferrari movie. I think is Scorsese attached to that? He was, if he's not doing it still. And I think Alec Baldwin at one point was going to play Ferrari or the. His or Lamborghini, the guy who. Anyway, this guy's story, Agnelli, it seems so much more interesting than Ferrari.
So where do we get to see this?
HBO on the HBO site and or HBO on demand, and a guy named Hooker, Jeff Hooker, I want to say maybe. Is the documentary filmmaker really, really well put together? Tons of great footage, and I highly recommend it.
What do you got? Anything you want to recommend?
It makes me think. Good documentaries. Dawson City, which you can get on Amazon right now and stream, is this. It ended up on a few top 10 lists here and there, and it's this beautiful, very odd experimental film. You have to kind of give it some time and sink into it. But they discovered these canisters of film from the turn of the century in Alaska and used them to kind of recreate what. Everyday life looked like in this town. And it is beautiful. And
like
it's
in the nook of the north.
It's just it feels modern too. It feels, you know, like turn of the century, so things are really happening. It feels, it just feels like you've found this time capsule, and it's gorgeous filmmaking. It's not buzzy or genre.
Black and white, the whole movie?
Yeah, and it's gorgeous. It's really beautifully, beautifully made.
I'm going with, I saw Brad Status, which is now out on demand. And on DVD, Blu-ray, and regular DVD. It's a Ben Stiller movie that came out in theaters about 6 or 7 months
ago.
Came
and went, man.
You know, it's kind of interesting. It's Ben Stiller is a dad who takes his son on college tour trips in all around the Boston area. And the kid is like a really talented musician. And... Ben Stiller.
Harvard, be lucky to get him.
Right. Is pulling all his strings to get the kid into Harvard, calling up a lot of his old college buddies who are infinitely more monetarily successful than he is. And he's kind of eating crow, and it's kind of like calling these people that he hasn't spoken to in a while. And he's feeling really bad that they've become more of a success than he is. So it's more of an examination of Ben Stiller reevaluating his life. You know, through the eyes of his college buddies while he's in these colleges. And Michael Sheen is in it, and Jemaine Clement is in it, and Jenna Fischer is in it playing his wife. And
who's the asshole, like, that he calls at the hospital when his there's another best friend of his that he's trying to get, that says he's a senator maybe or something?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Luke Wilson.
Luke Wilson, right.
Luke Wilson is in it. And
Mike White wrote it.
Mike White wrote it.
Did Enlightened and Beatrice at Dinner with screenplay for that. Yeah.
So,
Chuck and Buck, he's incredible.
So,
Chuck and Buck,
is the kind of movie that I would say to you, don't pay full price at the box office. Wait till it comes out on demand or on DVD. Well, it's on demand and on DVD.
I saw it too, and I agree completely. I saw it as well, and I agree completely. It was like a little gem that got away.
Yeah, and got any pick, Bill Vergola?
Actually, no. I'm actually...
He's going to take it on a gift certificate for next time.
That's right.
I've seen enough this year.
For next time. I've talked enough about movies for one day.
All right, so next week, what's opening up?
12 Strong. It's about the soldiers who were special forces unit. It was sent into Afghanistan right after 9/11. And actually, the whole story was declassified fairly recently, so we don't know about this. And the guys were forced to fight on horses. Most of them have never rode horses before.
It looks made up. When I see this trailer, I go, this can't really have happened in this day and age. These guys are riding horses over there, and it's for real.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
A movie called Den of Thieves opens next week. And another movie open wide, Forever My Girl, opens next week.
So we are in the wastelands, yeah, the toxic dump of January. Right.
But we'll talk about the Critics' Choice Awards and the results of that and compare them to the Golden Globes. And for Logan Hill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, man, for having me. Good to see you guys.
Logan, where can we see your work?
You can see me at loganhill.com. I put links up there to everything. And then at timestalks.com, we'll have links to all my conversations out of Sundance beginning next Friday.
Beautiful.
And Bill Bregoli.
I'm here.
We want
to
thank you.
If you want me, just go to Queens. Take the R line and the Steinway stop, and you'll find me.
Bill McCuddy, at Bill McCuddy.
At Bill McCuddy on Twitter. Follow me. I'm a special contributor this season to the New York Post and to goldderby.com. Follow me at both of those places.
Follow me at Neil Rosen Apples, and we'll be back next week. And as always, I want to thank you for sitting around talking movies with us.
If you're still here at this late.
And we'll sit around talking movies with you next week. And before we go, Bill, what do we do on the show every week?
I don't know. We sort of waste a lot of time, but we also watch the bad movies and streaming and TV, so you don't have to.
We do. We'll see you next week.